Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why did we evolve to want friends, and how has their role in our lives grown along with societal changes in families and lifestyles? As Americans today stay single later and have fewer children than ever before, many of us have more space in our lives for friends who feel as close as family members. And although it's rare to take a pal to dinner to commemorate the anniversary of the day you met, my guest will tell us that our friends have a significant effect on what we believe, what we do, and how we understand and define ourselves. Writer Carlin Flora is a former features editor for Psychology Today. Her new book is called Friendfluence: The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. She joins us from the NPR studios in New York City. Carlin, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
So most of us feel we already understand friendship, right? We've had friends our entire lives. What made you want to look at what the science says about the effects of friendship?
Right. So we certainly cherish our friends, but we don't tend to be as conscious about them as we are about other relationships. So, for example, there are thousands of books on how to improve your romantic relationship, thousands of books on parenting, and there's not much on the science of friends and how friends affect us. So it seems to be this relationship that, while we value it, we really haven't given it its due as a culture.
What is the evolutionary basis for forming relationships with people who do not share any DNA with us?
Right. So on the surface, this is a bit of a puzzle, right? Because if our purpose is to, propagate our genes, why do we become close to people who don't share them? And the answer is that in the evolutionary era, so to speak, when we lived in tribes, we very much depended on friends to do things like raise children, to hunt, to survive. And to be kicked out of a group was tantamount to dying. So forming these bonds was very important. And that's why anthropologists have gathered evidence of friendship throughout all cultures and as far back as we can assess.
So talk about the early childhood kinds of friendship skills that kids begin to develop. And I'm talking here about before adolescence.
Right. So some kids just naturally have these skills. And these will be things like, how do I insert myself into this game on the playground without being too aggressive, right? How do I sort of fall into that reciprocal give and take? How do I share information about myself and make myself charming and funny and attractive while also giving the other person some attention? And some kids just do this without being coached at all. And they will in turn sort of learn more about friendship on the job, so to speak. And then there are other kids who just don't naturally have these skills. And unfortunately, we don't tend to think of this as a skill that one can develop. And so we sometimes fail to teach kids how to make friends. And the unfortunate thing there is that then they can sort of slip further down this social spiral where the longer they go without making friends, the longer they will probably continue to not make friends and not fit into a group.
And I suppose being part of that group helps to develop, for the ones who get in initially, helps to develop further skills.
Absolutely. So those kids you really don't have to worry about. They're going to keep learning as they get into more complex and complicated friendships and alliances, et cetera. They're going to learn how to gossip, say, without gossiping too much, or they're going to learn how to deal with conflict and how to express your opinion without offending someone. And then other kids can get left out. And those are the kids who are really vulnerable, say, to bullying. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk lately about bullying, which is a great thing. But I think sometimes the friendship piece of the pie is left out, how having just one friend really protects a kid from being bullied.
So tell us about the transformation that is, at least in our culture, sort of universal between childhood and adolescence. Friendship becomes a different thing in adolescence.
Right. For adolescents, friendship is paramount. So friends, you know, are the people that you confide in even more than your parents. They're the people you're really modeling yourself after and sort of finding your identity through these people. And we tend to think about peer pressure in negative terms. It has a negative connotation. But teenage friends are socializing each other in really positive ways, too. You know, a teenager who has poor hygiene starts, you know, practicing good hygiene because they want to fit in with their friends, not because mom says you should do this. So I think it's important to realize that these kind of influences can be a really positive force for teens. And then, you know, there is some downside that kids will take risks more in front of their friends than they will when friends are watching, because they are kind of receptive to the rewards that risk-taking has when in the presence of their peers. So it does go both ways.
And it turns out that friends have a greater influence on how our kids turn out than we do as parents.
Right. So this is a bit of a controversial statement, but some researchers have argued this pretty convincingly, that apart from the genes that parents pass on, which are significant, that their behaviors don't really have an effect. So I'll give you one example is a study of parenting behaviors were sort of categorized as good or bad. And then the teenagers were looked at for their influences. And this was in an inner city neighborhood. And those who hung out with delinquents were more likely to become delinquents. And whether or not their parents had good parenting skills or bad parenting skills was irrelevant. So that's just one argument for sort of really being conscious of the peer group you're exposing your child to and how that peer group is going to shape them perhaps even more than your own behaviors. And that's quite a lesson in our sort of helicopter parenting era.
Well, and going back, Harlan, to what you said about the sort of biological reasons for friendship, rejection from a group is tantamount to death because you have to kind of go it on your own, or at least you did, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. It would make sense that teenagers who feel this evolutionary pressure, it feels like death to them if their in-group has pushed them out.
Right. So sometimes a teenager will say, I'll die if I don't get invited to so-and-so's party. And it sounds kind of, you know, histrionic, but they're tapping into this primal feeling. There's some really interesting neuroscience studies that show that social rejection is processed in the same part of the brain that physical pain is processed. So these two things are, you know, could be seen as the same kind of phenomenon from the brain's perspective. So this is real pain, getting kicked out. And again, it's this sort of protective impulse that we have to fit into the group or else.
So very often it seems that we just have made our friends naturally and we haven't necessarily gone to any deliberate effort to form those relationships. But is there sort of a formula of ingredients that makes the formation of friendships more likely in certain situations than in others?
Yes. Yeah, so we're very likely to choose friends who are just like us. So we choose people who are of a similar race and educational background and similar age. And this makes sense because we want to feel comfortable with people. And in order to sort of start sharing the intimacies that will ramp up a friendship, you know, it's simply easier to do that with someone if you assume that they think the same way that you do and see the world the same way that you do. And of course, you have to be near enough to them to, you know, run into them. That's why it's so easy to make friends in school or college, because you're simply running into the same people over and over. And it doesn't take much conscious effort. But really, one of the main points in my book is that we should be more conscious about how we form friendships. And instead of just kind of falling in with people who are just like us, we should take a step back and think about, you know, what kind of person do I want to be? Who do I admire? Because if we sort of choose friends that way, or at least have that in the back of our mind, then we're more likely to get in with a group who will really lift us up and influence us in a positive way.
One thing, Carlin, that I had not thought about that you discuss here is that having a wide circle of friends means we can look to different individuals to meet our needs depending on their best qualities. And then we, in turn, without realizing it, offer a sort of personalized brand of friendship back to the people in our lives.
Right. So we each have our strengths. I'm not very handy around the house, so I'm not going to be the person that my friends call if something's broken. But I like to listen to their problems. So hopefully they, you know, appreciate that about me. And the beauty of this, say, when compared to a romantic relationship, is that we don't have to commit to just one, right? And we kind of expect a spouse or a partner to be the end all and be all and fulfill all our needs and bring out all our sides. And it's just really not possible. So with friends, you can really have friends that draw out different parts of you and allow you to be sort of the most well-rounded and realized person that you can be.
I guess it's also possible to have pretty good friends with a very low amount of conflict. And you know, most people have experienced that it's hard to have a life partner or even a sibling without coming into conflict on a fairly regular basis.
Right. I think those relationships are more fraught. And now that, you know, we're in the holiday season, there's a lot of sort of joking about how am I going to get along with my relatives this holiday season. And if you ask people who have spent, say, Thanksgiving with friends last week, they're likely to report back that they had a marvelous time.
Is it easier to make friends? You know, you mentioned it's easy to make friends when we're younger. Is there something about getting older that makes it harder for people to form friendships, or it's simply that they don't have as many opportunities?
They don't have as many opportunities. And I think also they're busier. You know, people in midlife are often balancing career and work, trying to stay healthy. And it's just so hard to do all these things. And friends get bumped down to the bottom of the priority list. But what I would argue and what the science really backs up is that if you can just squeeze in a little time for friends, it, you know, makes you happier and healthier and gives you the energy to tackle all these other areas of your life.
How do our friends help us maintain strong relationships? Romantic relationships, I should say.
Right. So it partly goes back to what we were talking about before about, you know, fulfilling different needs. There's also some interesting research on couples who have other couple friends that they tend to be happier than those who don't have go on double dates. And I think part of that is just the double date allows you to sort of see your partner as she or he is shining and being, you know, his or her best self, which they sometimes aren't, you know, after many years spent together. So that's kind of an interesting way that they can help our other relationships. And I also just think, you know, stress and happiness and health, that some of the most compelling research about how friends influence us has to do with our physical health. We often sort of assume that if someone has a spouse, then that's sort of a built-in safety net if we should face a health challenge. But some research shows that having friends leads to better health outcomes, regardless of one has a spouse.
Well, tell us about some of that specifically. There are different outcomes, even for things as serious as breast cancer, depending on one's circle of friends.
That's right. So one study looked at some breast cancer patients, and those who had a strong a supportive group of friends were much more likely to survive than those who did not. And whether or not they had a spouse did not make a difference in that outcome. And then there was sort of a parallel study that looked at men. These were Swedish men and it sort of tracked their heart health over time. And it was the same thing. Those who had a great group of friends were less likely to have cardiac problems than those who did not. And having a spouse didn't make a difference one way or the other.
Hmm. On the other hand, if there have been studies in the past few years about people who struggle with bad habits, whether it's overeating or smoking or things like that, friends can be a good influence or they can be a bad influence, right?
Right. So all the more reason we need to be conscious of who we're becoming close to. You know, we're built, again, because of this evolutionary drive, to be fit into our group. And without even realizing it, we just adopt the norms of our group. So if our group goes and gets fast food every week and drinks a lot, it just becomes the norm and we don't question it. So things like drinking, smoking, and gaining weight all spread through friend groups. And then conversely, losing weight spreads through friend groups and getting healthier. So if you can choose to be around some healthy friends, that might do as much for you as stepping up your own exercise regime.
Is it accurate for life partners to call one another their best friends, or are those relationships something different, romantic relationships?
Well, you know what's so interesting about friendship is it's hard to pin down. And I think that's actually also its strength. Its flexibility is its strength because for many people, friends have become family members. A friend is the most prominent person or partner in his or her life, whether or not they're romantic. For other people, they feel the strongest part of their romantic relationship is a friendship. And what that means to them might be very individualized. And the beauty of it is that we don't have to make a strict black and white characterization. We can sort of let these two relationships flow back and forth and meet the needs of people depending on their circumstances.
Carlin Flora is with us. She's a former features editor for Psychology Today and author of the new book, Friendfluence, The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. If you'd like to share a story or ask a question, you can call in now to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former features editor for Psychology Today, Carlin Flora. Her new book is called Friendfluence: The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. You can join the conversation, tell us what your friends have done for you or what you have done for them, or you can ask a question at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Carlin, do friendships among women and friendships among men function very differently?
There are some differences. Of course, there are generalizations, but the standard line is that men conduct friendships side by side. You can think of them sharing an activity together, whereas women conduct them face to face, meaning that we're happy to sort of sit in a cafe and chat away. So that's sort of a basic difference, and men are not quite as likely to maintain friendships and work to keep up long-term relationships as women. But a lot of this is changing. For example, there are more cross-gender friendships than there ever used to be. Younger people are much more likely to identify having a good friend of the opposite sex than older people. And I think this is a great kind of friendship because it can really help give you insight into the opposite sex.
So the old thing in When Harry Met Sally may not be true for the millennials.
Yeah, it's absolutely not true. And it doesn't mean that these friendships can't be complicated and that attraction can't make these friendships awkward on, you know, for one or both parties. But people can overcome that and then really get the rewards of those relationships.
So there are friendships, there are tight bonds that we form early in life that sort of last throughout life. And then there are friends that we make that may be really important to us at different stages in our lives. What accounts for the differences between those relationships?
Mm-hmm. So these older friends, we're bonded with them because we go through so many changes throughout childhood and adolescence, and to have someone who shares the memories of what it was like to go through those rapidly changing experiences and who helped you really forge your identity, which is such a crucial task in life, those bonds remain strong. For people who sort of that we might connect with later in life, it's often because we're going through a similar circumstance. So new mothers tend to bond with other new mothers. Widows might become friends with other widows and so on and so forth. So I think it's really ideal to have both, to have people who really know who you are and share memories of your relatives, for example, who might have passed away. And know your behavioral patterns over the long term. And then also people who are going through the same things that you're going through in life right now who can give you more specific support.
I've been interested to discover on Facebook people that were an important part of my life maybe years ago that I wouldn't necessarily have ever looked up in the real world, but that have become sort of characters in my life once again because of this technology.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a really nice thing. We hear so much sort of negative, complaining about social media and how it's ruining friendships and we don't know who our friends are now. But I think there's just an enormous upside of, you know, being able to connect with people. Maybe you don't become best friends with them, but it's a really nice way to sort of think of and reflect on the past and even reconstruct the narrative of the past in a way that can be really positive for a lot of people.
Why do things like disparate income levels get in the way of friendship?
Well, I think it goes back to this principle that we're most comfortable having friends who are just like us. You know, we don't want to have to censor ourselves. We don't want to have to accommodate too much when we're thinking about what the other person might like. So when one friend sort of comes into money or conversely loses a job or loses money, it can be complicated to navigate that difference. You know, how are we going to go out to a fancy restaurant? Or are we going to go to a, you know, really cheap restaurant? And is someone going to feel bad about that? So it just introduces more conflicts. It makes things a little harder. But I think if both people are sensitive and honest about it, then it can be overcome. But it's just not our natural tendency.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Patricia in Fort Worth. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
My question is related to friendship and atypical neurology, like autism, for instance. I have various family members on the spectrum, and I know just from watching the social interplay how different it is. And, you know, people, obviously, making friends is difficult sometimes for people that just have a typical social networking ability. Have you checked that kind of thing out or done any observation in that area, or is that something that you might be pursuing? And have you seen, you know, maybe tips or different ways that I can help my son who is on the spectrum, and just things, you know, maybe tips to offer to the typical kids and how to help in terms of that kind of thing.
Thanks for your call.
Right. I think that's a great question. And, you know, people on the spectrum often have trouble with mind reading, which means, you know, kind of guessing what other people are thinking or feeling, and also interpreting facial expressions. So this can be a really big obstacle to forming friendships. I think that if kids, you know, particularly kids with Asperger's who may not have severe deficits, if they can just be told that friendship is a skill and a skill that can be learned, that can really motivate them to try to make these connections that are so hard for them to make. And one woman with Asperger's who I interviewed for the book said that something that really was a breakthrough for her was taking an improv acting class. And this really helped her to understand the sort of back and forth of social interaction that comes naturally to other people. You know, sometimes we assume that people on the spectrum don't want friends or aren't interested. And, you know, it couldn't be farther from the truth that they're desperate to connect, but just don't have those skills and abilities. So it can be done with hard work.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Meredith in McKinney. Hi, Meredith.
Hi, Chris. I'm a big fan of your show. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
Taking my call. My question for your guest is, my friends and I have discussed this. We tend to like different people for different strengths, like what you're mentioning earlier, and kind of saw the value of, you know, strengths and weaknesses. But some of my friends we've noticed among a group of us, there's some women that only want their core, shall I say, clique, and they're very protective. They don't like newcomers. And I've always just found that odd, and I just didn't know if you found anything in regards to that type of behavior in your research?
Yeah, I actually did. It's there's this tendency to become a little bit ruffled if our close friend becomes close to someone else. And it seems sort of silly because, as you're saying, we should all be able to develop different friendships and it shouldn't be a threatening sort of phenomenon, but it is threatening, and I think it goes back to this evolutionary psychological explanation that in the earlier era, we really needed a lifeline. We needed one person who we could count on in an emergency, and if that person is making other close friends, then that sort of sets off alarm bells. And, you know, this comes through with weddings where you have to sort of publicly declare who your best friends are. This is my maid of honor, and these are my bridesmaids. And people get very, very emotional around those issues of, you know, not being picked and who else is picked. And I think it's because we do have a need to sort of be number one on someone else's list. But just because we have that tendency doesn't mean we can't step back and say, okay, we're in a different era now, and it's fine if, you know, my best friend becomes close to someone else, and that could enrich me too.
I wonder if the reason that sometimes friendships are less stressful to us than other kinds of relationships is that often they don't require definition, but then when you have to put a label like this is my best friend, that's when things can get dicey.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, that we would just rather have it be unspoken and have people sort of interpret things the way they want to interpret them in a way that's flattering to them. And when we have to write it down on paper, then, yeah, it can really start to ruffle those feathers.
Okay, we all know that there are such things as toxic friendships. There are, you know, frenemies or whatever you want to call them. Why is it so hard to get these people out of our lives?
Well, a lot of times it's because they're really not all bad. If someone's truly toxic, most people will find a way to move away from that relationship. It's these so-called ambivalent friends where maybe we have, shared ties with them. Our families know each other, or maybe we've known them for a long time, or they're in our same field. And we do like them, but they also cause us a lot of stress. These people actually make our blood pressure shoot up more than people we outright do not like. So they're kind of worse for our health because you don't know what you're going to get. You go into an interaction and you're sort of tense because you don't know if you're going to have a good interaction or a bad interaction. So these are the really tricky friends. And I think we don't like to get rid of those because we don't like to think of ourselves as someone who gives up on a friend. And that can be kind of hard for our self-image. And also, we don't want to deal with the blow-up with a dramatic friend breakup because, you know, in our culture, we don't really have the sort of language or custom of a friend breakup. So it becomes this kind of conflict that we want to avoid. So we tend to just sort of live with this ambivalent friendship.
Yeah, it does seem weird. It's hard to imagine saying to another friend, oh, I broke up with Eleanor because we used to love to do this together and now we don't like to do it anymore. And so it's a matter, I guess, of making that known to the other person without making it so public.
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I think that most psychologists would say the best thing to do is back away slowly and just sort of turn down the interactions rather than have a dramatic ending.
So when we feel like we need new friends for whatever reason, how do we cultivate those relationships?
Right. So I think the first step is just kind of having a friendlier attitude when you're out and about rather than kind of keeping your head down and going where you're going, to really just be open to meeting acquaintances. And also just kind of, I think the low-hanging fruit would be your friends' friends. If there's someone that you see regularly at your friends' parties or events who you kind of click with, to really ask them to spend some time together. And it can feel a little awkward to ask people out on these friend dates, but it's really a great way. And most people will appreciate it, even if it feels awkward to you. A lot of people want more friendships.
Is there a good way to structure a friend date? Is there an ideal set of activities that we might look to?
Right. Well, I think, again, sort of akin to dating, that you want to, you know, start slowly before you get too involved with someone, especially if we're going to become conscious of friendships and, you know, what are the values and habits that this person has? Is this the type of person I want to be like in 5 years? I think that if you want to become more intimate with someone and ramp up the friendship, then you need to do a variety of activities. So don't, you know, sometimes you have a friendship where you always meet them for lunch during work hours. Well, you want to do something different. Maybe you want to go on a short trip with them, or you want to introduce them to your family. You want to see them in a variety of situations and places to really get to know them better.
So, Carlin, I think a lot of people have heard of the research that suggests that people who are religious are happier overall than people who are not. And many people who are of faith say, well, this is because I have a relationship with God. But it may also be that they have a relationship with the person sitting next to them on the pew.
Yeah, absolutely. Researchers who have looked at this have really believed that friendship is the secret ingredient here. And, you know, it's not to say that a personal relationship with God doesn't make people happy, but the thing that really keeps people coming back to church is the friendships that they make there. It's the community. So churches are really in the friendship business. And for that matter, it extends to work, too. We don't really think of work as being in the friendship business. In fact, we think the opposite, that maybe it's not quite smart to become too friendly with your coworkers. But it's absolutely true that if you have friends at work, you're more productive, you're happier at work, and you're sort of happier with your paycheck, no matter how little it is, if you have a best friend. So it just goes to show how those relationships kind of permeate these other areas of life that we don't associate with friendship.
Well, it makes perfect sense that you have the task to be done when you arrive at work, but you also, if you can see a bunch of friendly faces and you want to talk to them, it makes you want to go every day.
Yeah, it's so motivating, and it's just not something we think about when we think about, you know, career change or what kind of work environment do I want. We it's just sort of an afterthought, and so maybe to sort of put that at the front of your mind when you're job searching or contemplating your career would be wise.
It's funny, though, that people are very cynical about, you know, if you talk too much about work friendships, many people assume that means that you are just there to use the people who think they are your friends.
It's such a good point. And, you know, people have accused me of, oh, you're promoting social climbing because you're saying that you should befriend people who are successful. And it's, you know, you can do that and also form sincere, authentic friendships. It's not one or the other. You know, if you want to move up in a career, it's just smart to have friends who are already in that career. And you can also really connect with them and have that, you know, wonderful experience of, oh, this person gets me. And you can have both things at once, and it's just about sort of being smart. It's not about being shallow and using people.
Is there like a critical mass of friends that we need to derive all these health benefits that you've talked about?
Well, it's different for every person. Introverts, for example, sort of prefer fewer, stronger friendships, and extroverts have a need for more friendships. But, you know, one number that researchers throw around is five. So if you have, you know, five pretty good friends, that's great. And it just has such an effect. You know, having too few friends, you know, having not enough friends is the health risk equivalent of smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So that's got to be my favorite friend stat, is that that's just as dangerous as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Do people who struggle to make friends, are they typically aware of this part of themselves, or do they think there's something wrong with everyone else?
That's such a great question. I think some people, whether they're, you know, as the caller was alluding to, people on the autism spectrum or just people who seem to lack social skills, you know, I think it's really so personal. But if someone, that's where feedback could really change someone's life. If you can sort of point out what someone is doing wrong, and that's a really painful process. But if you can do that and get them to see what they're doing wrong, that could totally change their life. And so I think it's probably divided, that some people know that they're not connecting and they just can't figure out why. And it makes them feel very lonely. And other people just don't know what they're doing wrong and blame everyone else. But they're also isolating themselves. And loneliness is just a really terrible phenomenon for our health and our psychology.
Another interesting thing about friendship is that it is, of course, a give and take relationship. And yet most of us are happy, I guess, to a point, to give without expecting something in return if we're doing it for a friend.
Right. So you know, years ago, psychologists used to think about friends as being this sort of tit-for-tat relationship where scores, you know, people were keeping score. And that's actually the antithesis of friendship. The closer we are to someone, the less likely we are to keep score and the happier we are to just give. And giving is, it gives us such a great feeling. So it's a privilege, really.
My guest this hour is Carlin Flora. She's a former features editor for Psychology Today and author of the new book, Friendfluence: The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. Join the conversation. Tell us about your relationships with your friends, or maybe ask a question. You can do that at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Carlin Flora, former features editor for Psychology Today, who has written a book called Friendfluence: The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. You can be part of the conversation by emailing think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Carlin, you mentioned that many of us struggle with gossip because we are sort of wired to gossip, and yet this can be really bad for our friendships, and yet we can't hold back. Can you talk a little bit about the influence of it and what we can do to keep that urge in check?
Right. So gossip is a really efficient way for us to figure out what the norms of our group are. And that's why it's so vital. It's how we figure out, you know, what's correct, what's not correct. We sort of work out these hypothetical situations that we ourselves might face through gossip. And, you know, it's really a happy medium. I don't think it's realistic to say I'm never going to gossip, because it is a way of just functioning in a social group. But it's about not being mean-spirited and, you know, keeping the feelings of your really close friends close to you and not saying things that they wouldn't want you to say. So it's a very delicate balance. And, I laugh about the tiger mother. You might remember that she wouldn't let her kids go to sleepovers. And I think this is terrible, because sleepovers are, you know, a place where you learn how to gossip, and hopefully you see the consequences of going too far, and you see how to do it in sort of a light way.
And that takes us back to the point that you make, that many people who are parents see their kids struggling with the inevitable ups and downs of childhood friendships and would do anything to get in the way of that. Some of those ups and downs are probably good learning experiences.
Oh, they really are. And I think it's so hard as a parent. You don't want to see your child in pain, but they have to learn how to work those things out. And you can coach them, but if you get too involved, that's just a disaster. And, you know, you also have to be a role model. You know, I talked to some little girls from my book who said, oh, our moms gossip all the time, but they tell us not to do it. Hmm. You know, kids are aware of that hypocrisy. And also being a good role model by having friends over and showing your children that friendship is this rewarding part of adult life and that you're allowed as a parent to have your own social life and that can really enrich your children because it gives your children a variety of role models and ways to do things and live life that are different from the way you or your partner has chosen to live life.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to John in Stephenville. Hi, John.
Hi.
John, will you turn your radio off all the way, please?
Yes.
Thank you. All right, go right ahead, please.
I just have a question about relationships among women. Because of my job, my wife and I have had to move several times in the last few years, and it seems like when we get into a new community, my wife will make a friend, like with our children's daycare or whatever, and that other woman will seemingly be a good friend, but then when we're around other friends of that woman, she'll act like she doesn't know my wife. Hmm. And I'm just curious as to why there's that kind of antagonistic, sometimes hot and cold relationship between women.
That's a great question.
Yeah, it's too bad that's happened more than once. I think, you know, moving and making new friends is a really difficult challenge, difficult to trust people for the reason that you're saying. I think that for women, there often tends to be a little bit more drama in relationships than there are for men. And that's partly, ironically, because we tend to avoid conflict. So maybe your wife is afraid to speak up and say, hey, I didn't really like the way you treated me in front of your other friends because she's afraid of a big blow up. But ironically, that could lead to a bigger blow up down the line or the end of a friendship. So sometimes, you know, we women have to work on talking about the smaller slights and resentments so that we can avoid the loss of friendship down the line. And really just learning that conflict is consistent with friendship. And it's just something that we need to work through and face.
We did an interview on this show some time back about the value of friendships for girls and the fact that it's particularly good for adolescent girls to have more than one group of friends. So you have your friends at dance or at basketball, and then you have your friends at school or that sort of thing. Do you think that's true for all of us?
I don't think it's true for everyone because, again, some people just are really good at cultivating a few close friendships that really sustain them, and other people are more social and kind of need that variety. But I can see why this advice would be given for teenage girls because it's a time of identity exploration. And if you fall in with one group, you might, you know, sort of quickly lock down their values or interests. And if you allow yourself to kind of try out different potential grown-up identities, am I going to be a jock? Am I going to be, you know, someone who loves classical music? Am I going to be a scholar? Then that helps you sort of settle and decide on what is, you know, most reflective of your core self.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Fort Worth, where we have Deb on the line. Hi, Deb.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
I was wondering if many people have noticed that as they age and their friends become more intense, maybe in their religious or political beliefs, that they find themselves drifting apart.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think it's we just like to be with people who think like us. And that's why, you know, you see that reflected on the internet and what people read. They like to, you know, read things that confirm their own beliefs. So this extends to friendship. And I think when there's a shift in religiosity or a political change, it can be hard to feel, that we're two peas in the pod or we're as close as we used to be. On the other hand, there is some research that says that when we have friends who are a little different from us, whether in age or background, et cetera, that we can find those friendships to be really satisfying. So I think it has to do with respecting one another's belief and whether or not your friend is trying to drag you with her into her new beliefs or if she respects where you are on the spectrum.
How much do friends influence what we like, the kind of music we listen to? I mean, did we come together with them because we had common interests or do we form common interests because we're friends?
Right. So psychologists used to struggle with that question, is it selection or socialization? And they finally decided it's both. Mm-hmm. We were drawn to people like us, and then we continue to become more like the other person over time because of the closeness. So both forces are at work. So again, if you just kind of are really conscious during the selection process, you can influence how you're going to be socialized. And if you fall in with people like you, you're just going to become more and more like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Martha in Frisco. Hello, Martha.
Hi, I love your show. I'm a little nervous because I've been listening to you. And anyway, I'll try and be as concise as I can. I have people that consider me a very close friend. I'm a very giving person. I do lots and lots for my friends. I take very, very good care of them, a lot of times putting their needs way ahead of my own. But I have a really hard time letting them do the same for me. Mm. And I've been told that maybe I'm not as good a friend that I could be if I allowed people to help me the way I give to others. And I've always been curious if that's, does that make me selfish? What is that? It's troubling to me that I've been told that by more than one person, and I always thought I was a really giving type. So
wow.
That's my question.
Yeah, thanks for your call.
That's so interesting. I think it's true. When someone asks me for a favor, I feel good. I feel special. I feel important. When I do that favor, I feel competent. I feel helpful. These are all positive things. You're depriving your friends of those things because you're not asking them for help. And I think you obviously are a giving person. So for the way for you to reframe it is, I'm helping them by asking them for a favor. And I think given your personality, that will motivate you more than, you know, oh, I'm selfish, if you know. So just try to keep in mind that this, your friends want to help you, and then you'll sort of get the benefits of being helped and being cared for, and then it'll sort of be a virtuous circle that you'll see that you actually are not only helping them, but you're helping yourself by allowing them to do this. So you really just have to experiment and try it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Val on the line now in McKinney. Hi, Val.
Hi, yeah, very interesting topic. I was just having a question with regards to, women's relationships. I think, you know, they're a little bit more drama, like your guest was talking about previously. But, you know, how do you reconcile, you know, when there is a, like, one-way relationship? I mean, when one person is just always, you know, have to agree with the other person or just become a pet or, you know, you're just pretty much... maybe that's not a good analogy, but, like, you know, it just seems like no matter what one person does, the other one is a friend and he's just going to go along. And, you know, it seems like a little one way to me. And then, you know, just is that a true friendship? I mean, or what is, I mean, it just seems easier if you go along with the grain. But is that a real true friendship?
Do you mean, Val, like if you disagree with your friend, you don't necessarily want to upset her, but you feel like...
Correct.
Maybe,
okay. Correct.
All right. What do you think,
Correct.
Carly? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think if someone doesn't tolerate any disagreement, that's, you know, that's really hard. It's hard to be close to them. It's hard to have a true intimacy with someone who doesn't allow for, you know, for any disagreement. I also think it just depends on your overall friendship needs being fulfilled. If there are people who you're really close to who are very giving to you, then maybe it's worth having one friend who's a little bit selfish but who, you know, takes you to fun parties or, you know, has some sort of quality that you really do appreciate. But if she's your primary friend and this is the dynamic, then it doesn't sound healthy and it sounds like something that you need to talk about. Also, if it's a pattern for you that you get into these kind of one-way relationships, then you need to step back and figure out why that is.
What about, I think everyone has experienced this, the kind of relationship where you are a friend to someone who is sort of always in crisis, you know, and you still want to help that person, but it wears you out after a while.
Yeah, that can be really draining. And I think that's a situation where it's that ambivalent friendship where, yeah, you might feel close to them and really like them. But if every time, you know, you pick up the phone, they've got another sob story and you're the counselor. It's really draining. So again, I think maybe you have to have a conversation, and these conversations are so tough because it's kind of not done, and we prefer to sort of avoid these things altogether. But maybe the friend's not really aware of the imbalance, and you're doing her a favor by making her more self-aware.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Alex on the line in Dallas. Hi, Alex.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
My question was, I have had friendships where I want to make friends, and it seems like it goes off in a good start in the beginning, but then after a while, like I feel like the friendship isn't there no more. Like, they don't want to be my friend anymore. So it kind of brings, like, insecurity. Like, I'm thinking maybe no one else wants to be friends.
So what do you do about that, Carla? That certainly would be frustrating.
Yeah, that's really hard. And I commend you for making the effort to try to make friends, because it is so important for your health and your happiness. And, you know, it could be just maybe asking someone, hey, you know, we used to hang out and it seems like you're too busy now. I'd really love to see you again, or I'd love to do X or Y or Z, and see if they respond. Because sometimes people just do get wrapped up in their lives and they don't make the effort and they're not as conscientious as you are. But I think also, you know, if you're getting signals that someone kind of doesn't want to be friends, then, you know, maybe you do have to move on and try a different type of person. And all it really takes is one close friend to make a big difference in your life. So don't get discouraged.
I think many of us try not to take our friends as individuals for granted, right? But can you talk about what we gain by remembering to value the existence of friendship in the abstract?
That's a great question. I think it just goes back to the assumptions we have in our culture, that we assume that a family member is someone's primary connection, and it's just not true for a lot of people, especially because of the demographic changes that have swept our nation with, you know, more and more people living alone, people delaying marriage or not marrying at all, only children, older people who are sometimes divorced, widowed, or separated. A lot of people are not living in this traditional family environment. And so for us to sort of assume that they are is just really not the right way to think about how people are supported and how people are carrying on their lives. One example would be, you know, a health proxy. Health care workers are often very suspicious if a friend wants to sort of be the main person to navigate health concerns with someone who's seriously ill. They feel that this is suspicious and that a family member is more trustworthy. But as we know, that just doesn't really break down, that some family members are trustworthy and others aren't. Some friends are trustworthy and others aren't. So we need to kind of rethink how people are socially fulfilled.
Have you figured out what's special about those people? And everybody knows one that seem to make friends wherever they go, and they've never met a stranger. Are they just especially lucky? Are they just especially good at friendship?
Right. I think they do have a natural talent for being gregarious, for mind reading, which we talked about earlier, for, you know, making people feel special, sort of the Bill Clinton effect, where he looks into your eyes and makes you feel like, you know, you're the only person who exists. So it's sort of a charisma that I think does come naturally. But, you know, again, the basic friendship skills can be learned. So even if, you know, not all of us are going to become those charismatic Bill Clinton types, we can all really improve.
Carlin Flora is a former features editor for Psychology Today and author of the new book Friendfluence: The Surprising Ways Friends Make Us Who We Are. Carlin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. This was great.
Carlin joined us today from the studios of NPR in New York City. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Christine McConnell prepares our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.